done my sentence, but committed no crime. And bad mistakes, I've made a few.
Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's wrong.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
Now's my shit together, is my shit together.
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Yep.
Jocks.
Starks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here.
We're live. Loan up by Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen. Jim Lawler on the board. S&P futures up 24. NASDAQ futures up 194. We're trying to bounce back here a little bit after crummy last week. The rumor is that oil prices erase gains after Iran says U.S. talks could be pursued based on national interest. I don't know what the hell that means. Anyway, we have all that going for us, but we're dying to make a bounce here, and we'll see what happens with the money supply this month with our new tremendous Fed guy going to really get rid of inflation as he pours money into the system. Kind of a strange thing. Anyway, I don't suppose you had a chance to see the movie The Odyssey, Jimmy. Evidently, they broke records, but they did pretty good. It hasn't been a really big movie in a while. These guys did $124 million over the weekend.
Christopher Nolan?
Made actually a little bit more than that.
Yeah, 124.5. Domestic ticket
sales. John Lee.
Domestic ticket sales. 264 million globally.
Christopher Nolan is a Loyola Academy graduate in Wilmette. Parents grew up, he's British, but his parents grew up, he grew up in Barrington.
We know people from Loyola. Are they doing that well?
This is Loyola Academy for Boys.
Ah. You mean the high school?
Correct.
Which now has girls.
That is also correct.
Yeah, well, they've had girls for quite a while. Yeah, I have not seen the movie. It obviously is doing pretty well. And but I have read a couple of reviews. And one of the reviews, the guy pretty much threw up his hands and said, well, I guess that's this generation's Odyssey or something along those lines. Evidently, according to him, it was totally convoluted in terms of special effects and all other kinds of stuff from the original epic poem. I was going to say book, but it's really an epic poem. I have to assume you
two... Yeah, Tommy, actually the reviews I read thought that it was... The only criticism I saw was I didn't hear that at all.
Okay,
I heard that it was too long.
Well,
yeah. It was 3 hours. It was 3 hours long.
I remember... what's the longest movie you ever saw? I'm going to say The Longest Day was one of them. I thought, what was the one? 4 Hours of Blood and Sand. What the hell was that one with Lawrence of Arabia?
Lawrence of Arabia is 3 hours in this. The other one would be Dr. Zhivago also.
Oh, God, yeah. I don't think I ever made it through that one. Because they used to have intermissions in those. Free to go out and get a pop or go to the bathroom. Otherwise, that's kind of a long time. But I mean, obviously for those, I don't know if anybody reads them anymore, but it was required reading for us, the Iliad and the Odyssey, Homer. But it was it's a big deal. And there's been several of them. Didn't what's his name? Kirk Douglas was Ulysses in one of them, wasn't he? There have been one or two other ones
Spartacus,
made.
Spartacus, I think, was a long one, yes.
Yeah, but no, I mean, he was in the Odyssey, Kirk Douglas.
In one of the Odysseys, not the most.
I know they made one, but they just made one. They just made one several years ago, too.
Really? Well, it lends itself to all kinds of special effects with all the different, the sirens and those kinds of things that he's going by. Do they have a Cyclops in this one?
Yes.
You got to have a Cyclops.
Yep.
We need special effects for that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. We need more for the sirens, I think. You can really do something with that. Instead of just tying themselves to the mast like they did in the first one, it's easy enough to do. You can't... But, anywho, that's...
Yeah, it's the... I did read... Yeah, I read an amazingly high review for... by critics. I mean, it's in the 95 to 100%.
Really?
100% though. Oh, God, yeah. It's... I'm looking at...
Well, how close is it to the poem?
To the what?
How close is it to the script?
Well, which script? I mean, you know,
the actual poem, like,
many, many times.
No, it isn't. You can read the damn thing.
Yeah, no, but I mean, the actual poem has been reinterpreted. It's relatively close, yeah. But it's, Rotten Tomatoes has it at 95%. I mean, this is a 8,000. What? No, 3,000-year-old poem here. So
yes,
okay.
It has been everyone that's done it. Everyone that has done a movie on this has put their own interpretation on it. But it's got a phenomenal rating, and all the,
I didn't say anything was all being bad. All I said was
all of the reviews that came out or people that were going after the thing. But, the criticisms are that it can fumble, but they said the acting was very good. Anne Hathaway was very good. Samantha Morton, who plays one of the sirens. No, she plays one of the Greek mythical figures, they said is just phenomenal. And they said Damon's good, too. They said,
he's really good. But I guess the interpretation is in order to get the stuff from overseas... You have to really go big on special effects and just any movie, and people are very aware that 50% of the revenue comes from overseas. It's not wrong. It just is.
The other thing too. Don't forget that they filmed this on IMAX. I mean, film IMAX, which is So we have a 35 millimeter negative, right?
What?
IMAX negatives, that's what normal film is. IMAX negatives are 70. They're twice as big.
Well,
so I've been looking for a real 70 millimeter IMAX theater here, and they don't. We don't have them in Chicago. We don't have one. The closest is either Indianapolis or Grand Rapids.
No, we do. It's there's one in Navy Pier. There's only two of them in Chicago.
No, I thought there was one.
No, the one in Navy Pier closed. Okay, I was just researching this. They have laser IMAXs, but they don't have the 70 millimeter film IMAXs.
I thought they had one at the Museum of Science and Industry. No.
No. But you know, I'm planning to go see it.
Well, you know, I'm not. There's been all kinds of stories regarding 35 to 70 millimeter. There's been movies in 70 millimeter before. As a matter of fact, the little bit of a trivia piece, which probably nobody cares about. If you ask anybody when's the first big movie that John Wayne was in, everybody's going to say Stagecoach. And that's absolutely not true. He was in I think it used to be 16 millimeter, and then it went to. He was in something called the Big Country, or the Big Divide, or the Big Country, or something like that. That was filmed in like 1927-28, and between the time that they were done filming, and it was supposed to be released, the market crashed. So in order to put the movie on, all the movie theaters had to invest in this new stuff. I don't know if it was 35 to 70 or 16 to 35, whatever it was a jump in size. The Big Divide, I think it was, and it had all kinds of stuff in this movie, like you know, going to Oregon and something, and finding a, you know, all of a sudden there was a cliff, and they had this scene where they're lowering all the cows and oxen by sling over the cliff, and I mean the stuff was unreal, the filming. Well, it turns out the thing was a big failure because none of these places had the money to upgrade the equipment. So of course the studios, is the way they are, blame it all on the young John Wayne. So for the next 10 years he was in the 51 minute Odors, you know, the Man from Utah. They were like the movies you put on before. They were like the shorts. They were a little longer than a Three Stooges short, but they were the shorts, and they would play that before the feature film. And he had, I probably have 15 or 20 of them at home, and they're all the same. It's the same ramp where you go into the town. Every town's got the jail and whatever, and the bad guys had a black hat and a white guy. I mean, it's unbelievable. They're all exact. Man from Utah. There had to be, I'm thinking there had to be 25 of these things. Then all of a sudden he got his big break in Stagecoach against who was the one guy was a real good actor, and then the lady was an accomplished actress, and he held his own, and then he went on from there. But He had to go basically into purgatory for 10 years because of this movie. It had to do with equipment, just like you're talking about, John. What was the one that was it Hunt for Red October, or where they wouldn't let anybody use it in the movie theater if they didn't have the surround sound? Was it those guys? Was it some other movie? And all these movies are like...
Nah, I never heard that.
No, I think it was Jurassic Park.
It might have been Jurassic Park. So if you didn't have the right sound system, they wouldn't let the movie get it. This is kind of an ongoing ever since the part of. Did you ever go to one of those real? You just mentioned the name, John. The theater all the way around, where you actually lay back and look up. Like they had at Navy Pier at one time.
Oh, guys.
Yeah, did you ever go to those, Jimmy? No, I was at the one, and they have one at the Wright-Patterson Museum. And you go in and you sit in the seat and you lay back. You're staring straight up. You lay down, and was an, like an OmniMax, but there was stuff all like horizontal to you all the way to the top. In the first one, they had to give people basically barf bags because it had to do with first to fly, and they had all these gliders, and you were so much into it that you were getting airsick. I mean, they can make you do that with one of those things. I mean, this one, they took it easy on me. I did the one at the Wright-Patterson Museum, and it was freaky. I mean, literally, man, how many times you go to a movie seat and you lay back and you're looking down up like you're like you're in an MRI machine or something. And all of a sudden they start this thing, and it engulfs you. It's really something. Anyway, talking about getting off topic, but the I did go. I did have a nice thing this weekend, and the guys from the OEX pit 25 years ago. It's so long I've been in there. decides to have a little bit of a reunion at O'Callaghan's over on State and Hubbard or something. So of course I decide, all right, I'm going to go before I go out the odds. I'm going to go to this party. Of course she didn't want to come here because it's in the city. Boy, to get there and get a place to park, talk about brain surgery. So finally I get to the place. It's a parking garage.
Where's
Hubbard and Lake State.
Oh, okay.
The area is just alive with people, right? But of course Wells Street's closed for some festival. State Street's closed because of the job it's going to take the next 10 years on the train station. Place is just a mess. If I find a parking place, I go in, and of course it's going to be $30 for like 2 hours. And I get to the seventh floor and I go down and to one, right? Here I am, a dummy. No, I'll just press one. Oh no. One is not a pedestrian exit. I'm like, well, that's interesting. Go back to two. Well, it turns out I'd actually walked, by the time I found the elevator, I'm actually like a block and a half away from when I came in. So I spit out on like Upper Wabash, and I'm like, where the hell am I? So of course, being somewhat rational, I look around and I see, well, there's a river this way. Well, that's south. So now I know where I am, right? Once I got to buy bearings. I got to go down all these steps. Anyway, I find a place. It's 90 degrees. Bazillion people in every corner. Everybody's eating outside in this horrendous heat and air. I don't know, boy, it's nice to be young again.
This is on Friday or Saturday?
It's on Saturday afternoon, like 4 o'clock. 5
oh, okay.
And someone go to this party and met all these people. What a terrific group of people. And a bunch of them listened to the show. And one of them, Brian Patton, nice guy, Big Money Bunny, we used to call him, he says to me, yeah, I listen to the show every day. I like everybody. I really like that Hal guy. He likes to argue. And I go, no kidding. He goes, I love it when you guys are arguing back and forth. I go, yeah, what about me? He says, you can handle it. Okay, then.
Well, everyone loves you too, Chief.
Yeah, he says, in terms of guys that love to argue, I said, everybody loves to argue. That's why I got him on the show. He goes, well, yeah, they all, he goes, it's terrific. Anyway, the people were, everybody looks pretty good. Some better, some guys don't look like they've aged a day, which is even weirder, but some have aged some. But yeah, we were talking 80s and 90s when you stand next to somebody every single day for 20 years, I mean, you get a bond, and you watch them in their worst moments, their best moments, and they're always honest to people, and they never renege on a trade, no matter how bad, and you get an appreciation for people that you don't normally get, and just sort of, you met somebody yesterday kind of thing. Because there's no way you could back out on a trade, there's no way you could do anything like that, or it was your whole livelihood. And, you know, everybody's life, and pretty interesting stuff. But I had a good time, and for some of the time getting out of there was even more of a struggle, but I did. So that's what that all is. And we got Jimmy, fill us in on the soccer real quick. We'll have Mike on Wednesday.
We do have Mike on the line. We've asked him to unmute, but yesterday was Spain's master class on how their system works better than anyone else's. They play like a team, no one superstar. They don't funnel the ball to one person, and they play like a team, and they, did the, shall we say, the soccer rules on Messi. They crowded him, and they basically left him toothless. They tried to get Argentina to someone to step up. No one did.
When was the last time they got scored a penalty? Was it like 5 games in a row they shut people out?
6 games in a row. That's
wow.
Why their keeper won the Golden Hands Award, which is for the best keeper.
Well, yes, they didn't do anything.
No. He had a couple of saves. He played pretty well.
Well, I didn't say he didn't play, but the other guy had, 11 saves?
Yeah, Argentina played. He played very well, actually.
He did.
Well, Mike, our man Ricky, who's the Tuesday and Friday producer, he's been with Spain the whole way. Was that
he was right, obviously. And I'm glad that they beat Messi and the Argentinians, because a lot of complaints about Argentina playing very rough and somewhat dirty, and Spain didn't. Well, Spain did play a little dirty. There was a lot of pushing and shoving going on in the second half. So,
Mike, when it seems to me that when the game's that close, God's sake, you can't get a spot where you're going to get kicked out. The guy whacked that one guy. That was pretty dirty play.
Just a quick one here. Was it my imagination, or is that the refs and on the second half kind of I was surprised at the red card, but it's kind of let it play. All right, play ball. You know, it's they were not calling some of the pushing and shoving like I think that I've seen in other games, or is that just, you know, just me imagining?
Yeah, Mike, expand on that one more. John just said it. It seems
they did kind of let them play, but it was only a red card because it was second yellow. It was his second yellow card of the game. The first one was kind of a cheap call. He probably shouldn't have done what he did. The second one was very flagrant, and I think it was a legitimate call to kick him out or give him the red card, because it was just it was very poor play. And but the Argentinians had kind of done that the whole time. But and the style of play, as one of your friends said there, Tom, about the shutouts. Spain had 7 shutouts during this World Cup. Only one goal scored against them, and that's a World Cup record also. And as the other comment,
John and Jim.
Yeah, I think it's Jim said they played as a team, and they always played as a team. That guy's methods, their coach, they all subjugated themselves to a team. It wasn't. That's the problem with Argentina. It revolves too much around Messi, and you can crowd him some, but he came up with some things in the other games. But for instance, in the Egypt game, Argentina should have been down 3-0, and Egypt, I think, should have beat them. But that's another story. So, but the most entertaining game of the whole tournament was England versus France. I mean, that was an unbelievable game, and
was a wild game.
I mean, I've never seen a game like that where England played flawlessly for the first half. Then, France came back and they were going to make it a game, or they were making it a game. And then actually England had to bring Bellingham back on, and he gives that penalty kick to Saka, which was great sportsmanship. And then he gets his own goal anyways later on to set a record for England for an English player in the World Cup to have 7 goals. So it all kind of worked out well. And
what do you
Mbappe
mean
they got a couple of goals, and he played well. But in the first half, France looked like, as one of the announcers said, they looked like they were hungover.
Mike, is the third place game enough for guys to care about it, or are they still pissed off they lost the first one?
Well, I think England really cared about it, because they want to, as once again some of those announcers said, they want to win the Euro tournament, which is 2 years from now. So it's the big tournament in Europe, and it's held on off or every 2 year, or it's every 4 years, but it's on the 2 year off year mark for or in Europe.
Yeah, Spain had won previously 2 years ago.
Right, exactly, and they had beaten France 2 years ago too.
Well, what's the in terms of penalty calls for those that are total neophytes like me? Obviously, if you miss, I think the definition of the proper tackle is as long as you get the ball first, if you keep going and take out the guy's legs and stuff, it's legal, correct? If you whack him first, it's pretty damn dangerous.
If you make contact with the ball first.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Then the contact afterwards is looked at, but I would agree with both John and Mike. They did let him play. It's no different in sports. There's holding in every call in football. In basketball, someone's holding someone down on there, or an elbow is flying. The question was, Argentina plays rough. You could say it's dirty, but Spain did not let them get under their skin where England did. Now, Mike, you had mentioned something about Bellingham coming back in. Was he is if he was subbed out, he cannot come back in.
No, he was never subbed out. They didn't start him in the game. He and Harry Kane were supposed to be on the bench the whole game, but they ended up bringing Bellingham in the second half.
Well, Mike, what's the just in terms of? I'm going to follow up on my just in terms of other kinds of quote penalties and physicality. If all of a sudden like people are lining up for a goal. And one guy's got a spot, and the other guy's like, no, that's my spot. And they did, you know, they kind of jostle and push and shove, and as usual, you know, the big strong guy does a little bit better. But what exactly is the rule on that? I mean, sometimes it gets pretty intense, and sometimes they pretty much stand next to each other and not without hassling each other. What do you have? How bad does it have to be? I've seen a couple guys get calls, but they weren't cards or anything, where a guy just turns around and shoves the other guy down. That's
right. The ref yesterday, he was kind of explaining to one of the Argentine players that you cannot essentially grab both arms and hold him down. His motion was essentially enclosing the guy almost in a body hold. And when they pull them down. That one guy, I think it was when the Americans were playing, and there was a pull down of a person, and that was called a foul, I think. So it's all in how strong the holding or the. It's almost as if they're blocking out a guy from a rebound, and that's what it really became quite apparent. That's more on the headers out on the field, but it's when the players get pulled down that it's really.
It
blatant.
Seemed really confusing when people use, I'll use the basketball analogy of a pick where somebody will see a guy running, all of a sudden he slows down, and the guy runs into him. It seemed like they called it one way one time and another way the next time because
it was confusing on that. I agree. And
what is the rule?
Well, I don't think they can set a pick, but I don't know that for a fact because some of these rules, I mean, they were coming up with stuff. Well, it seemed on the fly to me, but there was one rule about using the VAR in this game, and it never had been used before for some foul. And my big complaint about this World Cup is, you know, they called the offsides very closely. They used the VAR to do that. But they should kind of have the same technical ability on the fouls on the field because that's so subjective, as both John and Jim have said. It's as if the ref, you know, he's not consistent even, like, for 5 or 10 minutes. He's making calls that 2 minutes ago he let go. So it might be consistent to him.
Hey, Mike, I've got one quick question. I know this is probably really old news. The red card that we got at our last game, was that he certainly stepped. I mean, when I saw how that ankle was twisted, I said, "Well, I don't think that guy's going to walk again." I mean, was that a valid red card? I mean, just I know nothing about it. Just curious.
There's some debate on that, but I would say it was a semi-valid red card.
Okay.
And once again, that's a subjective opinion.
Well, it comes down to whether it's an intent injury. It's like, is it sort of like in hockey, Mike? If there's blood, it's 5 minutes. If there's not, there's two. It's the same thing.
I don't think they go that far, Tom. I don't know. I haven't been watching the European, or not the European, the English Premier League, and they're pretty rough there, and that's where some of the roughness comes from, because I'm not sure they're as rough in, for instance, Spain or in Italy. But all I know is I think the English Premier League is probably the roughest league in the world.
Well, I mean, a couple of the ones, it seems like everybody, the announcers even didn't, you see somebody free with the ball, and somebody comes running to essentially intercept him. couple times guys just got in their way and there was a big bang and somebody got called, and sometimes the guy just stopped and went around him. It seemed like it was sort of undefined. It seemed kind of weird. Where in basketball, yeah, you pretty much can do that, as long as you don't move, right? But these guys are kind of...
So what about Messi? Did he... is the analogy like Ohtani in the last World Series a little quiet, or would they just double-team the hell out of him?
I think they double-teamed him very well, and
they
he has slowed down some, I mean, to a degree, but his strength is he kind of sees how the play is going and then is able to follow up. He gets a lot of, well, he had those two assists during the previous game where when they won against England, and he had some great goals during the thing. But I think he capitalizes to some degree on the weak teams too, but you know, that's another story.
Like my nephews, or everybody, my nephews, of course, nephews being nephews, they always have a different point of view. And when one of them has said that Messi has been clocked as walking an average of 75 minutes in the last four games or something instead of running, and what they did is they made him run. They made him get back to midfield a bunch of times and kind of took him out of his game. But has he turned into like a Wayne Gretzky when he got older, where he just kind of hung around and waited for the goals?
I think to a degree, yes. But he sets up a lot of goals too, and you know, he capitalizes very well on the opponent's mistakes too. And yesterday with the Argentinians, it was their passing was sloppy, more so than it has been the whole tournament. I think they were tired too. And also keep in mind, Spain had an extra day of rest because their game was the day before Argentina and England's, and I think it was probably an easier game.
That's a little. When I first saw that, I thought that was kind of weird. Then Argentina's had like how many extra times in a row too?
Yes, that's true.
But also, let me just interject, gentlemen. The show that Spain's team, that one midfielder from Spain who took it, who blocked Messi's shot with his face, a lot of guys won't do that. They'll turn away. He stood his ground and took it right in the face.
And you're right. He did.
And that don't see very often.
Well, and that was Marino, and that was actually one of their primary strikers at the time. He was in there to provide offense, but he was really helping out on defense too, and he did get smacked. I'm surprised he didn't get a concussion out of that.
Maybe he did.
I remember seeing that, and I went, what the hell?
Because most of the time they will turn their bodies away, and that also plays to Messi's game because he can bend the ball. This guy just did not. I mean, he saw Messi's shot and he went right in front of it. Sort of like Duncan Keith.
Well, there was one of the
losing his teeth.
Well, there was one of the penalty kicks, one of the earlier games. You know, not the one where there can be nobody in front of the goalie, just outside where everybody lines up. And one of the dudes was going right at his head and he moved his head. Went right in. He blocked the goalie big time.
Exactly. This guy didn't. He made himself a one man wall and just blocked.
Well, what, Mike? If you have any thoughts, I mean, we can do this another day. What's the final on the scratcho? I mean, the money on this, because I went to, like I said, I was telling these guys I went to this little deal with my index guys some years ago, and the city here is absolutely alive and a buzz. And then I went to typical story. I duck out of there early to take Audrey to dinner. Of course, she says I didn't think you'd be here on time, so I already ate. So. Anyway, I stop at this little bar near her place, little Irish place. Normally, you can't even get a seat at the bar because the regulars are there. So I sit down next to some guy in a Sox outfit, and he's telling me about how he's in the convention business where they make all the stuff that people use for their booths, you know, from the high end to the low end. And he says business is they're losing people, and he says Vegas is losing, you know, you can gamble anywhere now pretty much. And he said they're so expensive that it's not the convention hub, even though it's built up for it. He said, but Chicago is still real strong. I mean, he goes, McCormick Place is full. Well, from what you've been telling us week to week regarding the deal that these people wanted to make with the city, I think Chicago's full. Why would we have wanted a game here and kick everybody else out? I mean, I guess you would hope that all those conventions would reschedule, but maybe they wouldn't. And you were saying half the time you're capping these people hotel rooms and stuff in the city. Why, if you're busy, why would you want them, I guess is my question.
Well, Tom, I kind of agree with you. Some of the cities that they picked, well, I mean, Dallas, good stadium. Kansas City, good stadium. Philly, I don't know about how good the stadium was, and I don't know which, well, I think I know which one they played in. Boston, you know, they just picked venues that they thought people were willing to work with them, and I guess Chicago didn't need to work with them, so... I think there was money to be made for everybody.
FIFA is so used to getting its way. I did know a person that was responsible for selling the media rights to FIFA, to the World Cup out in, for Asia. I knew this guy. And the stories he would tell you, I mean, it's their way of the highway. And there was one clause Rahm Emanuel didn't like and wouldn't sign up. And also, as you said, I mean, we still, thank God, have a pretty good convention trade.
I don't know how you'd ever surrender your best month convention wise in July or August to FIFA if you didn't. I heard a lot of people from. The Scotland group, Mike, I think a lot of them stayed in Providence, didn't they?
I have no idea, Tom. All I know is I think they played in Boston twice in their group. So they probably did very well up there. And England was up there for a game, I think, too. I think actually England, as you said the other day, I think they traveled more than anybody else.
Well, that was Jimmy did some work on that. He said they were 20,000 miles.
Right.
That's kind of a number.
Something. Yeah.
So the next World Cup, I think, is in Spain, Morocco, and Portugal.
Yes.
Yeah.
That would be.
I would love to go see there, see some of those games.
Well, now there are more teams, though, right, Mike?
Well, there's still going to be the 48 teams, so that's and people will not want to play in Morocco, I think, but who knows?
I thought you were saying that they're adding some teams.
No, I was just speculating, Tom. They're at 48. I don't know whether they're going to be at 48 and then go to 64. I think they're at 48 for a while. It worked in the States and Mexico and Canada, and it would probably work in Portugal and Spain, well, and Morocco, because they can host, and they're all those countries are all relatively together. So, because it's not a bad trip to go from Spain to Morocco and Portugal. So.
Somebody said something about six other teams. I don't know how that would work, but maybe it's another more play-in game.
No, to me, it would have to be.
Wants to expand it to 64 teams.
Well, so if you had to take it from the top, I mean, it's a little early. I mean, we can speculate today, and we'll dig into it more next time you're on. But, and Jan, feel free. In terms of FIFA always makes dough, right? I mean, so they're fine. They're going back and forth in the private jet rather than trying to rent a car in Mexico City and drive to Seattle. That's a little tough. But so they made dough. Some of the cities maybe did, maybe didn't, right? The people who had their sponsorship on the stadiums that couldn't use the sponsorships, that to me is always interesting. I heard that one of my buddies, I think Bill Murphy was telling me, that the deal with Rahm, and Rahm said basically go pound sand, they wanted all the parking at Soldier Field. They wanted all the concessions. I mean, it was the list of what they want. It was like Spalding. I want a hamburger. I want a hot dog. And Rahm Emanuel would take one look at it and said, not here, or something along those lines.
They also, with a big one, was that I read an article on it. I think it was in the Wall Street Journal or something. But they wanted the ability to have, to require that a stadium be covered. And he says, we're not going to put a roof on Soldier Field. I mean, give me a break. That was the big issue. But now, FIFA's the corruption, I don't know, I can't say now, but boy, it used to be so bad. I mean, they would have some pretty sketchy people.
Well, now, they get the team got 50, the winning team got $51 million, right, or something along those lines? There was something about
no
it.
No idea.
Lou has a guy. He hasn't been on in a while. But his career is essentially taxation for the, you know, big ball players and big movie stars, and they're going to have to pay all that tax in New York, right? In New Jersey.
I kind of doubt it. That they're foreign countries, or they're players for foreign countries. I don't think they're going to have to pay any U.S. taxes.
We'll check this out, Mike, next time you're on, because I have a feeling. I mean, in New Jersey, they charge you if you're from Chicago, for God's sake, for the game.
Doesn't it depend on where you're being paid? Tom. Those are still U.S. teams and U.S. Well, for the most part, U.S. players. But this is an international thing, and I'm sure, just as John said, FIFA's, you know, kind of writing their own terms. And if it's their way or the highway, and that's the way it's always been with them. Look at the last two sites for the World Cup was Qatar and Russia. It was Sochi. So, you know, they get whatever they want.
For another date. I'm gonna make the dollar bet, my friend Mr. Murphy, that they're paying taxes here. That nobody,
all right,
nobody's getting a $2 million check here. If they pay taxes here, I bet it counts against them at home. That part I get.
Well, who knows? The reason why I came on today, and I should have told you, is I can't do it Wednesday because we're going out to El Paso. So
okay, we'll do it next week when all this stuff. What did John Carmichael write in the wake of the news? Next week we'll do a financial redo. How does that sound?
Well, that would mean I'd have to do research, Tom.
Well, we'll help. Jimmy likes doing that, and I'll do some. We'll figure it out. But the, you know, I have a feeling that they, I can't imagine the U.S. letting somebody out of here with a $50 million check. And, you know, these guys, I mean, I say these guys, Mike, you've known me for freaking how long. I think there's a limit on how much you can tax somebody. And I think the limit's more like 25% or 30%. But
the European limit is 50%.
I know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But then again, there's
let
stuff.
Let me ask something. I don't think if you're picked to be on a national team, let's take the U.S. team, I don't think they're paid. They may be paid a stipend. But I don't think that no one has $10 million deal to play for the U.S. team because it's. They assemble them and disband them all the time.
They must have sponsors. They must split the sponsor revenue somehow. Plus, they all have individual sponsors, I would think.
Yeah, they all have individual sponsors. So,
but if these guys
aren't being paid.
It does depend on, John, the country. Some countries do pay their players quite well, such as, that country, the African country,
Costa Rica?
Cape Verde?
Cape Verde pays them pretty well. The European teams, you're probably right. These guys make so much money, it's not even... It's ridiculous. You have, the U.S. guys, this and that, and then they find out what the European soccer players or football players make, and it makes them look really small. It's amazing. So... I think they do it for honor. I think they do get a stipend, but you're right. The European players make way. I mean, you're talking almost $200 million a year. It's ridiculous what they get paid.
Well, how many games do they play?
A lot.
Okay, well, there's the difference right there. Right? I mean, if the football players were able to play 40 games, they get paid more, too.
They also, like they were saying, Haaland gets... Right now, he's with Manchester City. His average monthly paycheck is 750,000 euros. It's kind of ridiculous what they do pay these guys. His contract is about 150 million.
Well, how is it any different from the NFL players or the NBA players? They're all overpaid.
I'm not going to argue with that. It's just kind of funny. It's like, you know. The NFL player is like, well, you know, I'm making $100 million, but it's over 7 years. You don't realize that some of these guys are being paid $100 million a year.
Well, they're paying. It all comes to everybody. You know, we're all part of, and I think all of us, me too, especially because the numbers are getting so big. We need to grow out of our blue collar roots. It's not about what the guy's getting paid and whether we think it's too much. It's how much the Monopoly League is making and how much the players have managed to get a piece of it. I mean, I think all of us should look at it from the other end a little bit.
Well, and that's true, Tom. And it's the players, and in the NFL, it's the risk of injury is high. In NBA, your career is relatively short. Baseball, maybe a little longer, but still, there's a risk of more injury. Although there is some risk of injury in football, in European football. So, it all depends on where you're playing and how the game is, or what the game is.
But you can look at a basketball player and say, that guy's not worth that kind of dough, but I like to play basketball and I never got paid. But you know those dudes, what is their contract, Mike? Or is it, they're guaranteed 45% of the revenue. Well, hell, it's not like it's 90, right? That's the NBA. That's why they have to pay those guys somebody. That's why you got to pay a dude that much, because I think the contract is they got to, is it 42%, 45% of the league revenue. And I'm sure the league probably finds a way to keep concessions out of there and parking out of there. So I'm sure they're cheating on these guys. They're adding it up in their own way. And so the players are they're over 40%, and everybody's – I mean, my mentality is, well, how much are the other idiots paying, making in their Monopoly League, right? I mean, that's the way I look at
things. Well, in the NFL, those owners are making a lot of money. So
yeah, that's what I'm saying. But the problem with the NFL is it's such a beat-up sport. Imagine if those guys could play 45 games.
Right. Well, we both know they can't.
Yeah.
So their careers are shorter than 5 years, except for the linemen, maybe.
Yeah.
But the running backs, the quarterbacks get protected too. But for the most part, their careers are very short in the NFL.
Mike, if you had another son, if you could pop one out, I think you'd want the guy to be a long snapper.
You're probably right, Tom. That wouldn't be a bad job.
But, you know, Mike, you just brought up something that I was watching the Cubs play the other day. And one of the guys on the Cubs made it the 10-year mark. The pitcher, was it Boyd, Jimmy?
I believe so, yes.
And they were talking about how many people do you think, I don't know if they started in the 1800s, but say since 1900, I'm just making that up, that date. How many people do you think have played Major League Baseball for, like, one day?
Oh, I've heard those stats before, Tom. It's probably less than 50,000.
It's like 25-ish to 30,000.
Right.
And less than 10% of them have had a 10-year career. So only, like, 2,500 people in the whole history of baseball have had a 10-year career. I mean, you talk about the top of the gene pool. It's really something, isn't it?
Well, it's, and I guess it depends a lot on what position they play, too, but, and their teams and whatever, so.
They're saying that the guys who were doing it, was it Cullen and Ryan Dempster, were doing the game on Saturday. By the way, it's not like I dislike the guy, but Jambi can stay on sabbatical forever, as far as I'm concerned. I think Cullen's way better, don't you, Jimmy? Anyway, that's just
yes.
me. But the Cullen's the guy that worked his way up from AAA Iowa. As he did the Cub games there for him. And the guy's really good. Plus, he knows all these guys from when they were in minor leagues. So, actually, he knows the team better than anybody. But, anyway, he was. They were talking about this, and Dempster going, he goes, even if you're a guy who, is kind of at the end of the bench and you're a pinch hitter or you're doing this or you're the last guy in the bullpen, he goes, anybody who's 10 years, everybody looks at him like saying, that guy's a god. He goes, it's unreal because it is so, I mean, it's not that rare, but it's really rare when you think about it. And I never thought of it. He was a player. I mean, he goes, yeah, anybody who's 10 years, that guy's got something. He has to get along with everybody. He has to be there when you need him. He has to do the job right, even if he's not, a superstar. It was pretty interesting. But, so let's, when you get back, what's in El Paso, Mike? Is one of the kids down there?
Patrick assumes command of a brigade, Tom.
Wow, good for him.
I think I told you that before.
Yeah. Now, what does that mean? I mean, a brigade is...
A brigade is roughly between 1,500 and 2,000 people.
Oh, that's a colonel?
That is a colonel. That's correct. A full colonel, but just colonel is correct.
But now there's a fort down there, and it, those guys are training at
the... Fort Bliss is there, but he won't work out of Fort Bliss. He assumes command at Bliss because that's where the unit is right now. And then when he's in command, they'll primarily... Well, it's a reserve unit, so they're in Phoenix. They're headquartered in Phoenix. And their big operation when he's in command will be an exercise in Africa. Actually, in Morocco.
Really?
So, yeah.
I mean, they're going there.
So is he... I assume this is your son you're talking about, but...
I've met him. Really nice kid. Really nice kid.
He's in... obviously the Army.
Yes.
What kind of brigade is this?
It's a logistical support brigade, and it's a little weird, but now he's what's called an executive leader, and that's what the brigade command is about. So they're putting him in a position where he doesn't have all that much experience in logistics. He has some, but for the most part, his experience is in other fields. Plus, he's very familiar with Africa now. He's worked at AFRICOM for the last about 4.5 years. So
that'd be a fascinating place to work.
Yeah, and he's enjoyed it too. So,
Mike, how much of the logistical stuff, I guess, this is another topic for another day. How much can he control? I mean, if the stuff isn't being fed to him by somebody else,
That's exactly right, Tom. But once it gets to them, they have to coordinate how to get it to the units that they're supposed to be supplying. So that's the critical thing. So, for instance, right now, the unit that he's going to assume command of, a lot of their personnel are at Fort Bliss helping other units, mobilize to go to wherever they are, other reserve units and reserve personnel to go deploy to somewhere else. So, for instance, if somebody was going to go to Ukraine or Poland or whatever, reserve guys, then Patrick's unit would help them do that. And essentially, after he assumes command, that mission goes away, and then they go back to their normal mission, which is still reserve logistics, but they'll be doing it out of Phoenix. And generally, if they've been mobilized for a reason, they can't be mobilized for about 2 or 3 years after that.
Well, now, when you say reserve, these are the guys that...
So is your son regular Army, or is he reserved right now?
No, he's a reserve right now. He originally went in, and he was regular Army, but he got out and went into the reserves.
So my cousin, he was offered a striker brigade, and this is 20 years ago, to go into Iraq, and because of family situation, he turned it down, and so he left it lieutenant colonel. But to make colonel... It's a real honor. I mean, that's you're one of them, as my cousin told me.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So congratulations to your son.
Well, Mike, the reserve guys are the 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks in the summer guys?
Yes, that's correct, Tom.
I don't think it's quite like that anymore. I mean, we deployed a lot of reserve guys in our war on terror.
We're talking about the National Guard. I'm trying to get the connection here between the National Guard and the Reserve guys. The National Guard is what, Mike? It's different?
The National Guard are usually subordinate to the states, Tom, and they kind of do local things. Patrick's in the U.S. Army Reserve, and then his unit can do local things, but it can also do major deployments. So,
well, when I was, we were, before COVID and stuff, we used to go out and see our family in Columbus. Of course, not a lot of them are left, but... In those kinds, in states like Ohio, people are all over this stuff. In Chicago, nobody gives a crap, but nobody gives a crap. I mean, in Ohio, you pick up the Columbus paper, and of course, I'm the first guy up. There's all these towns around Columbus where this reserve unit or this National Guard unit that were Jeep mechanics or tank mechanics were going to Afghanistan, or these guys were going to Iraq. It was all, some of them were reserve, some of them were National Guard, and they were going for several months, and they were like the... And that's what was kind of weird about the Afghanistan stuff, which you know better because your son was there. I mean, these guys were getting killed behind the lines. And
But that's war, Tom.
Well, but I'm saying normally the National Guard is 50 miles behind the lines, you know, replacing the motors on the Jeeps. But that's not. But they were back and forth. But the National Guard can be called up as well. But it's usually for a specific, like these guys, your son's in. These are for logistics. It's usually for a. It's like the air refueling wing out of O'Hare, right? If they had to
that's
go somewhere,
correct.
They
yeah.
were. So.
But, you know, also in a major conflict, the National Guard's just going to be a normal unit. They're
okay.
going to be just like anybody else. So, you know, World War II, all of the, you know, whether it was National Guard, Reserves, or Active Army, or Active Marines, whatever, they were all in the mix. So it just depends on the level of conflict.
It seems like way more of a small town thing, though, doesn't it? At least the National Guard piece.
Because it affects the small town more. And it's like that in the South, too, you know. So it just depends on where you are. The major cities, it doesn't seem to affect them as much because there's... Although, that's not true either because there's plenty of reserve units around New York, too.
Yeah, well, I mean, Chicago somehow... They must be here, but then, you know, because they must be arrested around the Illinois. You just... It's never front page in a Tribune, let's put it that way, where it clearly is front page in a Columbus Dispatch, wherever the hell it is.
Right.
So when you get back, we'll do the money recap on the whole mess, and I'll try and find out about the taxation, and it'll be fun. We'll do that, and you know, maybe we'll do that when Kevin's on or whatever. But our Monday is always good. We're
all right,
easy.
And I apologize for interjecting myself.
Hey, no problem.
Monday morning.
I was hoping this week. Today's fine. That way, I'll just talk to Kevin for an hour on Wednesday. That's always good too. So that's fine.
Congratulations to your family.
Yes.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Absolutely. So, have a nice time.
It is quite an honor for Patrick to get this.
Right? Oh God. Well, when you guys went to Washington, how long ago? He was made colonel.
No, actually, we went to Stuttgart for that time. That was
okay.
About 3 years ago.
I know you went somewheres.
Right.
Well, good for you. And tell him I said hello if he remembers me.
All right.
Mr. Flanagan, you with us?
I'm with you. Good morning, John, Jim.
Well, yeah, that was fun because it was obviously a lot of the news and this weekend and the money part. I think Rom did us a favor telling him to stay out of here. We got to watch it and didn't have to put up with it.
Well, would you trade NASCAR for the World Cup?
Yeah. I would too.
Well, NASCAR's going
to... NASCAR is such a disruption to the average Chicago who doesn't get that much time out of a year to enjoy the park anyway. And I don't know, revenue-wise, it doesn't sound like it's you know, an important contribution to the city's problem, you know, solving. So
we kicked them to Joliet.
Well, this is maybe the last year. I was reading somewhere. So.
No, it's in Joliet this year. It's not here. It's not in the city this year.
It's not here. I think it's going to come back next year.
Well, it might, but it's been booted to Joliet. That's where they're having it. They actually have a NASCAR track down there. Where, you know, it's where it belongs. Kind of a huge track down there. You guys ever driven by it? I think it's massive. And they moved it down there. But it's not on the street. It's on a regular track.
Really, that was that the NASCAR thing in Chicago. I think was, you know, a good idea on paper to bring excitement into the city. But the reality of it, people just did not understand that. You know, and I had just moved here, so you guys tell me. But I heard that parts of the South Loop were closed for a month beforehand.
Oh yeah,
they're already closed for Lollapalooza, for God's sake.
And, I mean, geez, you know, my gosh,
Michigan Avenue, everything. But you guys, you have to. No, you're on Stacks and Jacks.
It wasn't just a weekend. It wasn't just a week. It was like a long time.
I know, but it's way more than a week. But you got to put up the benches. They did all that. But let me help you guys.
The traffic's that food.
But if we're in the bench construction business and we get the job, it's a spectacular thing. Who cares if somebody's inconvenienced? I've got the Portalette contract.
Doubt.
It's all about who gets this. Those guys think it's terrific. The rest of us, not so much. What do you think? Why do you build a new stadium?
The World Cup was a stunning success in Chicago in 94.
Yeah.
But, you know, I really think this time around, I don't know where the police union weighed in on this, but I could see how a lot of people would be leery of hosting something of that scope, given, you know, the shortages we've got in police on a day-to-day basis, let alone for a huge infusion of international tourists. So there might have been more resistance here than they're letting you know, or the reasons for it too.
Yeah, they do the same thing as they did for the what they do for the Democratic convention. Everybody who was had any extra time from all the suburban forces came in. They double the force. They you can find guys. Hell, you're gonna have guys moonlight from ICE, take their masks off.
And if it's the DNC, they'll spend money, you know, with absolutely no regard. So
well, they do the same thing if the Republicans are here. They just do it for everybody. They don't care. Plus, some of that money comes from the parties, doesn't it?
when they had it,
yeah. When they had it, yeah. But you know, it all comes down to you pick the winners and the losers, and the people we know are never in the winner column, which gets aggravating after a while, right? I don't really. I mean, I don't know any. Remember the first year they had the NASCAR where the guys who put up the benches, they didn't put, I don't know if you really could, but they didn't have any lightning defense. There were no lightning rods or anything. So as soon as lightning, they had to clean the whole town. Where do all those people go? They had what, 50,000-60,000 people in benches along Lakeshore Drive? Oh no, you can't be in the stands anymore. Where were you supposed to go? You gonna lay down in the middle of the field, hoping you don't get stung in the back of the neck or what?
Go to the Pritzker Music Pavilion.
Remember the evacuation? Nobody had any place to go. It's you just can't be here anymore, right? So we'll do a total post mortem on this, maybe on a Wednesday or something, or on a Monday when Jimmy's here, because he likes to talk about it and he does a lot of research for us. But hey, John, before we get to the other, we've been talking with Nancy and Audrey today a little bit. This is John Flanagan. I read the other day that the amount of home sales now to first-time buyers is now down to 21%, which is an abysmal new low. We've been kind of hinting at that for quite a while, the four of us. Is that kind of confirmation that it's not such a good thing?
Yeah, it's a terrible thing. We've talked on the show several times on the problems of a young family starting out, or a single person or anything else getting into the real estate market, and trying to make any money without bankrupt yourself in the process. And it's just it's ever delayed more and more, or postponed indefinitely. So I think this is going to play out in a way. It's kind of like, since I always thought home ownership was the way to amassing family wealth, especially if you didn't have any to begin with. But the longer you have to wait to start amassing wealth, the less wealth you have to pass on. So,
well, yeah, I think they're worried about. I don't think they're talking about a car. They're not talking about a house. I don't think they're talking about a baby at all.
No.
Not that anybody's really wants one of those dropped on us, but at one point, I guess we do.
I was listening to some podcasts yesterday. And they were talking, these were based, focused on Korea and Japan. And they were talking about the cost. We talk about a young family trying to get started. And of course, over there, the hot topic is, the birth rate is so low. Okay, like 0.72. The replacement rate is 2.1. We're at 1.7. The Chinese are at 1.4 for replacement birth rates. And, the reason why, and these are all very well known. But if you want to be screwed, go to Korea and try to rent. Did you know that 50 to 60% of the rental contracts is you put down 50 to 70% of the value of the apartment, and then you get your money back in 2 years with no interest. You don't pay rent. So if the apartment's worth $100,000. This is what the rental contract is. You put down $60,000, you get it back in 2 years. Then you pay maintenance too. So then the landlord then gets to collect interest, and there's obviously a little problem, especially when landlords go bankrupt or they just take off. I mean, it's horrendous.
But he's not making any money with the interest on the $60,000. There must be some implied rent somewhere.
Yeah, is this in lieu of rent, John, or is it?
This is in lieu of paying, we pay a damage deposit and then we pay a monthly rent. Over there, you pay 50 to 60%, 50 up to 70% of the value of the real estate. They keep it for 2 years, and that's your rent. Okay, then they give it back to you. But the problem is, you know, in 10 to 15, 20% of the time, they don't give it back to you.
Well, but that sucks on both ends. It's nowhere near enough rent for the landlord, and how do you come up with the money on your end?
Yeah, so it's just, you know, yeah, how if you're starting off even to rent, how do you, you know, I got to tell you, I don't think when I was 22, I would have had, you know, 50 to 70% of the value of an apartment. But it's just an amazingly, it's tough everywhere.
Well, the Chicago is reaching a point where...
And they were talking about, you know, then they have the other factors of why. But real estate is a big issue overseas on why they're not starting families. And they said that, you know, we shouldn't be cocky here in the States because we're right around the corner of people starting families. Who's going to start a family when you can't even afford a place to live?
Well, that's a problem. Yeah, I mean, I've talked about the young people that Jimmy and I run into around here. They're still around in the exchange community. Most of them are in regulation of all things. They're 32 years old. The thought of, most of them don't even have a girlfriend. I mean, that's too expensive.
No.
You know, the cost of going out.
No, they don't. No.
This generation
is not doing that.
I talked to our favorite bartender at the Tripoli the other night, and she said that she and Nick went to one of the concerts at Wrigley Field. I don't know which one it was. And they had two mixed drinks, $45. What is that all about?
God.
I mean, I know beers are $12.
$45, two
yeah,
mixed drinks.
Yeah. She goes, we're not going back. I mean, what the hell? But the guy owns a bar. He knows how much it costs to make the mixed drink, right? It was like $22 a piece.
Or actually, you know, a mandatory tip in there, too.
It was probably $20 a piece plus tax.
How much is a beer at Wrigley Field now?
Jimmy, $12.50?
Oh, no. Up.
Really?
Try
15?
It's
17 something, isn't it?
$16.99.
Yeah.
Sox Park is actually a buck or two cheaper, but you will spend, if you had three or four beers at either place, you're now talking close to $50. And hot dogs are $9. They got you.
Well, we did a thing one day. Jimmy, you weren't on the board, but somebody was. And they went through all the different ballparks. Somebody's still $5 for a beer. I think it might be Atlanta or St. Louis or somebody. Somebody's down to like $5. Or it might be Coors Field. I think it is maybe Coors Field.
It could be, but I mean,
five or six, something like that.
I just know where it is in Chicago, and it isn't cheap.
Well, I mean, I was in Myers yesterday. You wander by, I think, they get 16 ounces, right? Not 12, I think. I think it's 12 16-ounce beers at Myers yesterday on sale was like $1 a beer. Maybe not even that for a 16-ouncer. Like, it was like 12 16-ouncers for like $10.50 or $11. So for those guys, they're going to get what? Their revenue is 16 to 1. That's pretty good. In fact, that's real good. We're in the wrong business. I mean, when that's what happens when people get monopolies and right now we have, I mean, I got to be, out of all the different people around here and all the stuff we argue about, I would say, Mr. Flanagan, that our central theme of the show is how this whole economy is split apart. To some people, you know, that's chump change. To other people, it's like, what are you talking about? It's 4 hours work or something along those lines. So what we're talking about, you know, people bitching, and for some reasons, you know, there's a reason to it. If you're making minimum wage, 1 hour's work is now equal one beer at Wrigley Field. What the hell is that all about? That's interesting, huh? And one of the listeners just I talked to somebody that wasn't, I don't know where it was, but some lady got a nice new job, and she bought her mom a car, a Lexus. And I go, all right, 80? No, only 72. I don't think it was the best Lexus. So tax on that is what, 9 or something? So you're going to pay like $7,000 in tax, for God's sake? That's more than I paid for my first five cars combined, the tax on the damn thing. Remember when we had the what was the...
There was not a high tax on the Model T, Tom. Come on now.
No. what did we have? What was the tax we did during the Reagan era? It was the if something was too expensive, it was some kind of a... What was the name of that?
Luxury tax.
Yeah, luxury tax.
Luxury tax. Yeah, I remember that.
So they had this thing at the old Chicago Stadium where, talk about a weird day. They wanted guys. It was 4-on-4 basketball, right on the floor, so it was kind of cool. And I sponsored this team, and I had stopped playing like 2 years before. I mean, I was still okay to play, but I just had stopped playing in leagues. And one thing about basketball. If you stop playing, you lose your instincts like instantly. At least I did. If you're not playing 2-3 times a week, you can't play. But that's another story. So I get there and I'm like our first alternate, right? So we got this team, four guys. We're pretty good. This one young kid's playing for him, and he's working for him. He's real good. Of course, he turns an ankle like 3 seconds into the first game. You know, so I'm in. I'm like, okay. So we lose after 3 games. So I go, okay, I'm done. Well, meanwhile, other guys are falling during the day, and I foolishly did not get hurt, right? So now I'm playing. My first game was at 8, and I'm still playing at 5, and I'm dying, right? Well, in the meantime, BMW must have thought that all these guys from the exchanges must have a bunch of dough. So they got all these BMWs, you know, pulled into the stadium. So I'm walking along all sweated up, and the guy goes, hey, hop in this one. And I go... And the thing at the time was like $50,000 or $45,000 or something. So the luxury tax was 10. And I go, hey, I'm all sweated up. You don't want me in your car. Ah, that's no problem. Just hop right in. Well, I didn't hop in. And I said, you know, buddy, I'll take your word for it. $35,000 or $40,000 for a car. This is America. I'm guessing it's a nice car. How couldn't it be when all the other cars are like, you know, 10 or something? And what even more than that? So this thing actually was like 60. This must have been 90 something. So the luxury tax and the other tax and it totaled up to be like $12,000. And I go, let me help you. The luxury tax on this jalopy is more than every car I've owned together, and I've owned like 5 of them. The guy's like looking at me. Obviously, I was not his person, but the thing was pretty nice. I mean, it was obviously it ought to be nice. It was $50,000 back in whenever that was. But I got my name up on the scoreboard because I made it to the last game. To say how stiff I was that night, you don't even want to hear about it. I mean, I was the last game.
Well, gentlemen, I need to get moving here.
All right, take care, buddy. Yep. Talk to you next week. I'll see you before.
We didn't get a chance to chat.
Hey, the big Tripoli golf outings today. They're a big party tonight. If you're around,
I won't be, but I'll be back. I'll be by Wednesday through Friday.
All right, well, see you. Okay.
Anyways, talk to you later.
So, John,
have a good one, John.
So, John, what do you make of the intersection between the finances, the war? Kevin says Rockies beer can be as low as $3. Toronto, $4.50, and the Angels are $4.50. So it's good. It's good we're number one at something, isn't it?
Yeah,
you got to be number one at something. You know what else really feel was Kevin? Kevin gets some of the wildest stuff. He found a site. Jimmy, you don't want to hear about this if you're going to Cub game. He found a site where they somehow, without like filming people in the bathroom, studies how many stadiums are designed in such a way where people that go to the men and ladies room wash their hands.
Oh God!
And it has to do with, you know, say if the urinals are in one spot, if they have all kinds of sinks, and you got to walk by like 20 of them, and there's some that are empty. Most people will say, and run over and wash their hands. Even if you really want to, when there's 5 people waiting, people will walk out the door. Well, I think St. Louis, by far, something like 90% of the people wash their hands. In Wrigley, it was like 25 or something. Because Wrigley, when you put your foot on the thing and you get like a fountain to wash your hands with, they went through every stadium. And some of the ones that were brand new weren't that good, but St. Louis was far and away, whoever designed the men's and ladies room. How's that for a dumb stat I just thought off the top of my head? Anyway, so we had the market jumping all over the place. Today we're up. We're up 29 in the NASDAQ, or SPOOS, 240 in the NASDAQ. We've had individual stocks up and down. Today Micron's up 40. It was down a bunch last week. The amount of money that's changing hands in terms of valuation on a daily basis is something that I can't believe. So if somebody's not in the market all day like I am, I don't know how you can believe it. We're talking about, you know, 200 billion dollars in market cap swinging in a day when everybody else is worried about the price of beer at Wrigley Field. It's incredible. Plus, 2-3 years ago, all you had to do was talk about a tech stock. You bought the QQQs, or you bought, you know, Microsoft, or you bought Apple. They all, some did better than others, but by and large, if there was a tech rally, they'd all be up or they'd all be down. You know, not every day, but now every single day when Microsoft is down, you look and you know Micron's up, which is weird. You look and see that, you know, like the Adobes of the world, they're going to be, well, actually, Adobe's with the Microsoft group, they're down. But there's ones that work, move together now and ones that don't. And it's, I don't know, the older market guys will say this is the mark of a really topped out market when this stuff starts to happen in fragments. You look at some of the numbers, and the thing I really can't fathom about the current administration, John, it seems there's a collective, and these guys are smart. I mean, I don't know about Trump, but the other people around him, they're not idiots. They must know what I know, you would think. Yet there doesn't seem to be any respect whatsoever for the amount of money we owe and who we owe it to. Or is that just, I mean, I know your politics are different than mine, but I don't think I'm wrong here, do you?
Well, you know, I know we have to have somebody show up for our, you know, the Treasury auction, or we're in deep trouble. So there's people keeping us afloat that, you know, we need to consider how to placate them or to, you know, please them in some way so that we don't lose them as customers.
How about not insult them?
Yeah, well, that's part of it too. but I totally get that. I just, you know, I'm, if this was, were something like, you know, in any other time period, I think the U.S. was able to kind of look, you know, over its nose at everybody else and say, you know, we're not making the mistakes you are, and you need us more than we need you, and blah, 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 and would have, you know, felt very comfortable that way. Now we're all in trouble. I mean, and we're all kind of intertwined in a way where it's like one half step from letting somebody slide, you know, off the merry-go-round, and everybody else is going to start sliding off with them. There are no real out-and-out winners right now that I can see on the international stage. And, I mean, far from it, most of them are basket cases, it looks to me.
Yeah.
And not just what's happening on their balance sheets or in their, you know, influence, you know, in other markets or politically, but just internally, they're all being, like, shredded. There isn't any agreement on, you know, what this nation is or how we're supposed to go forward and who do we owe responsibility to first in this country. What are we running this country for? There's just a complete lack of coordination and, you know, caring about this kind of stuff. And I'm just kind of, you know, I guess maybe we look good by comparison to some of the European countries, but it isn't any better here when you look at what's happening politically.
Well, the concept of relative health and relative value has always been a real tough one.
You know, something really bothers me too about the DSA movement, Tom. And, you know, I mean, any kind of upheaval in our somewhat ossified political alignments, where, you know, the so-called two-party system—if that's what it really is—I don't know anymore. But it bothers me that you've got, you know, sort of a trend now that nobody seems to be particularly alarmed about, although I'm sure a lot of
you and I are.
Yeah, but, you know, every city of really any consequence that has ever been a magnet for business or immigration or culture is under assault, such that they're turning them into intolerable places for business and for its citizens. And I just try to put this into some kind of a, you know, a frame to study it. If you're not willing to fight for, say, New York as, you know, something that, you know, it really has every right to be, when it comes to its size and interest and excitement, blah, blah. But if you can just walk away from it and say, I'm not going to buck what's going on here, you're participating in something that's the kind of slide and collapse that a whole range of enemies, and maybe they don't even think of themselves as enemies of us today, but this is precisely what they would want. Once you start demoralizing a population about the things it should be valuing and protecting, you can demoralize them in lots of other ways. And I think that we're succeeding in that game. I don't think any of these countries, us included, have a real sense of what's worth protecting anymore, or what really needs to be done to kind of shake people up to say that when everybody is, disregarding of their history and their culture and their formal government, and everything seems to be on the table for renegotiation, you've got real trouble.
Dan, I think
politics is one bad actor to start the whole thing going. It's like a Sarajevo all over again.
Though, despite the amount of jousting back and forth with the people on the show of different points of view, I'm sensing that pretty much everybody is coming to somewhat the same conclusion in certain ways. I think you could, if you could poke George Stigler and clone the guy and get him out of his grave, and probably a few of those other old economists, or even some of the new guys, and give them the economic history of the last, probably since 68, but certainly since 82, certainly since 2000, certainly 2008, and you start to see the splintering of who's got money and who doesn't, and what the average person can do with their paycheck, and does having a job mean that you're really employed, or does it mean you're just salaried unemployed? I mean, I think that those guys could predict exactly what we're talking about now, and I see myself falling off what I consider to be my. I mean, again, I went to see my buddies Saturday night that we traded in training pit together. We're the best of friends, yet we competed with each other every day. I find it very healthy. I don't like tax rates where one person pays less than another versus another. I don't think you should penalize somebody who's smarter or works harder or is just maybe even a little luckier. But we've gone way beyond that to where... I find myself, I'm surely not in the socialist camp, but I also recognize that what we have now is so far from the people on the trading floor competing every day, and you congratulated the person who won, and you hope tomorrow was your winning day. We're so far away from that, to the point where even on stuff like taxation, I would never have said, boy, you got to make sure you get money out of this guy. But I would never have thought that. But yet I see the people that are the very progressive types, and I wish I could get them in front of me and in front of a blackboard and try and explain to them why they think the way they think, and why it's really kind of, I think it's wrong as a solution. But I'm not about to quibble with what they're seeing. When you start talking about, and Carl talks about all the time, Elon Musk got all his money from the government, pretty much. And every time you and I don't buy new cars all the time, we bought a new car, the guy got a check. Well, if you find a way where this guy now has the percentage of money of the next 10,000 people or 100,000 people, you better find a way to not give him a tax dodge, because that's where the money is. I mean, in a pure play, I mean, I don't, when somebody who, whose dad was fortunate enough, or mom was fortunate enough to buy, 50,000 shares of Apple when they were $5, or now all of a sudden the stock's $3.32, for no tax to be paid on that anywhere just because the person croaked. God, John, I mean, I'm not talking about a 90% tax like in Sweden or some damn place. I'm talking about, how about 20%? I mean, when people look at this and say we've got to tax the rich, I don't want to do that, because in our generation, the people who had more money are people that just worked a little harder. Somebody worked on Saturday, somebody else played golf. You don't penalize somebody for that. But all of a sudden, if they got their nose up the ass of government and somebody's got $1 trillion and other people got 48 cents in their pocket, you can't tax the person with 48 cents in his pocket. There's nothing there. I mean, this has got my own thoughts all screwed up with what these guys are doing. I mean, I think you understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Oh, and it's, the drive for, electric vehicles, and this is part of this passion that people have about suppressing fossil fuel development and usage, and I think politically that was an easy thing for the government to be swayed by, and if they wanted some beneficiary of it, Musk was a really easy figure to pick, and it was all part of the same, I think, corrupt thinking. That it's quasi-religious. You can't have fossil fuels. We need to pursue other forms of energy for the car that now very few people can even afford. If you want to buy Musk's vehicles, but this was part of the same slide, where everybody turned off their brains and just decided this is fossil fuels bad, EV is good, solar good, everything else. And we've seen where this has taken place, countries in Europe, just completely down the crapper. And we somehow, put it impossible to imagine wealth in somebody's hands over this same kind of religious mantra, thinking we were doing good. And, who was doing best by it? I think Elon Musk. But,
well, John, there were electric cars. Someday, if you and I are ever wandering around northwestern and northeastern Indiana, we'll go to the Auburn Duesenberg Car Museum. A lot of cars used to be electric when they were first making them in the 20s.
It was sold to women drivers because this was very low maintenance. You didn't have gotten cranked the thing. It was very hard for it to break down. Maybe the battery ran down, or you had a loose connection or something. But by and large, you could tell women, you could drive this thing, go anywhere you want. You won't have smoke fumes, belching at your passengers. And you'll look good in it, and they designed them.
Well, plus it took, how many steps to start a Model T? Like 12?
Oh, my God. And you break in your hand in the process. Yeah. There was a period where this was an alternative. And they sold well, and it cultivated a whole generation of drivers, mostly women. I mean, this really, I think, put women into the driver's seat.
With this whole concept of taking, I know that there are projects that only the government can really undertake. I mean, I don't know that an individual could have done the atomic bomb project. I don't think an individual could have done Hoover Dam. I don't think you could have done the Tennessee Valley Authority. I don't think you could have done the Golden Gate Bridge. Well, there's a lot of that stuff makes sense. There's things that government has to do, but why can't we just let people do it on their own? If somebody lives in, people know what they use their vehicles for. I mean, if I had the family, I never had a family, unfortunately, maybe, but if I had the family in the burbs, and and I had three vehicles, and I had some property, why wouldn't I want a little windmill on a roof or a solar collector? Or I'm sure that I could cut a deal with the electric company where if I only charge my car at night when they got nothing but power, why wouldn't, if I had three cars, one of them be electric to zoom back and forth to the bar in the food store? I mean, it would let people. But don't try and tell me I need an electric pickup for hauling horse trailers around all day. We're not there yet. Why can't we just let people do it on their own? Why do we have to? Oh no, we're gonna do this. We're gonna make this huge subsidy. We're gonna say why can't people? I just have much more confidence in people making their own decisions. I think if we just left it all alone, we'd end up with 10, 20, 25% of the cars in the proper in areas where they make sense. That those people will use them. And I don't know why, when I drove my pick-me-up that I bought in Tucson across northern Arizona and New Mexico, God, John, the relentless winds and the relentless sun, and I see the Santa Fe tracks right off to my left, and they're using diesel locomotives. Well, for God's sake, out here, between the wind and the sun, you could easily have a 500-600-mile stretch where the locomotives are all electric. Why not? I mean, let people make those decisions on their own instead of trying to influence constantly. And the one thing you don't want to do is make everybody go all electric and then tear down the power plants. Well, that really is kind of ignorant, isn't it?
Well, and in the meantime, too, even before you get to that point, the drive for ever more efficient, combustion engines in you know, just the smallest car to make it more and more expensive for a car for anybody to buy in this kind of quasi-religious, you know, pursuit of the least possible harm to the planet. Well, I'm sorry, you know, I don't buy any of that stuff anymore. We're harming the planet.
Well, we got to go to break here.
To do with fossil fuels.
We got to go to break, but you won't catch me in a truck past 2007. I don't want one of the engines where the cylinders turn off, and the minute they screw up, the thing dies, and you need a new engine for $5,000. I don't want one of those. What are we saving? Quarter mile a gallon? For what? Anyway.
And all, you know, all the crazy features like auto stop, you know, which you have to disable every time you start up the car. And you know, it was the concession to, you know, the government to do this. But you know, what kind of gas savings are we really talking about here? And why are we so possessed with saving this stuff? And then you're driving up the cost to a point that very few people can afford a car at all.
I'll tell you this, though, John. This crummy park, not crummy. It's a parking lot that I park in. Where it's, let's just say my truck is too big for the parking lot. I could roll with a rear camera because I can't always. I could do that. SP Futures up 30. NASDAQ Futures up 254. Be like right back with Audrey. We'll talk about the new amount of people that are first-time buyers in houses and how she's dealing with it. How can anybody deal with it? We'll be right back. Stocks and Jocks.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
And we're back.
Hello and welcome back to Stock Jocks. I'm Tavon Jimmy on the board. SP Futures up 32. NASDAQ Futures up 271. We're trying to make up for last lousy week here. Dow Futures up 77. As usual, we got the flippers here. Micron up 40. They were just down a bunch. AMD, who runs with Micron these days, they're up 20. And we got Microsoft down $3. I've got Caterpillar up 13. Caterpillar goes up and down 1.5-2 points a day. I have no idea why that is. Goldman Sachs up $5. Microsoft, like I said, is down. We've got NVIDIA's up 340. They're back up to 206. They threatened to go under 200, but they never really did. Over in Asia, these guys had a horrible day on Friday, and they're not doing so hot today either. Nikkei down another 2,600. You know what? I don't think they didn't trade today, but they were down 4% on Friday, as everybody recalls. Hang Seng is trading today. They're up 580. They were down a bunch on Friday, but they bounced back 2%. Shanghai up 32.8. So Nikkei, I don't know exactly why they're closed today, but they are closed. Over in Europe, DAX up 57.2. FTSE down 29.3. CAC up 33.4. So generally higher over there. Because U.S. oil is down a little bit, which we'll talk about in a second. Bonds up 2 basis points, 4.56. So even though they were down a little bit, the interest rates last week were still above 4.5 on a 10-year, which probably is not all that good. Oil is down 12 cents, 82.37. So it was down more earlier, but it's kind of unchanged. Gold down 360, so it's just hanging over 4,000. It's not doing much. Silver, however, is up 72 cents. That's 1.3%, 57.05. Foreign exchange, the Dow right where it's been, 114.2 against the euro, unchanged actually against the pound. Japanese yen still over 162, 162.38. That's danger for those guys. And we've got Bitcoin up 288.64, 667. community efforts, traffic, weather, sports, and air. Can we brief today?
Well, let's go to the weather. Right now, Chicago does have an air quality alert. It is currently,
but I can see the building, though, so it's got to be better than the other day.
We still have some wildfire smoke. We will have some strong thunderstorms later today. We are at 69 and a high of 85. In Phoenix, right now it's 92. It'll be a high of 107. They also have thunderstorms. In traffic, it looks like light. The inbound Kennedy is at 19 minutes. The inbound Edens right now is at 33. The inbound Eisenhower at 28. And the inbound Dan Ryan is at 16. In sports, well, we already know that the Spain won the World Cup. The Cubs won, and I believe the Sox won as well. Yes, they did. So overall, it was a good day in Chicago. Back to you, Chief.
We have Audrey?
I believe so.
Hey, Aud, how are you?
Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
We're good. We're doing the best we can, considering.
Well, I don't know. I'll let you guys run with that one for so far.
So we're not supposed to breathe. You know, that's right. Kind of a problem. Although you can breathe a little more than the other day. They canceled the soccer game and everything the other night. It was pretty bad. But
that's supposed to go outdoors, you know? It's like the lockdown.
Well, then you open
Tara, this is the first time ever in my life that I've actually felt that. I had to be out and about for work during the week, and by Thursday and Friday, I was out and my eyes were burning, my nose was burning, and I was starting to wheeze. So it was amazingly terrible.
Yeah, well, yeah. Thursday was three times worse than
Hey, Jimmy, your mic's open.
We're three times worse than the worst level ever before. So anyway, so the number came out this week, and you and Nance have been, painting a picture from your experience, which is obviously pretty darn accurate, about who your buyers are now. And were you somewhat shocked that the first time buyers are down to 21% of home closing? Is the lowest record before was 24, wasn't it, John? I mean, it's way below the number that the previous problem with that. I don't suspect that's unexpected for you or Nance, is it? Bud?
No, I think that it's indicative of just the pricing. I mean, after a while, anything else, the lower-end people are getting squeezed out. So they're fighting several things. They're fighting, obviously, the interest rate and then the lack of inventory. And you're still fighting that, which is, I'm grateful that actually President Trump has actually done something about it, gotten rid of stopped these corporations from buying thousands of homes at a crack and, basically taking them away. Buyers. I mean, there were these groups would come in and just buy literally thousands of homes, and most of them were lower priced fixed homes, rehabs, some were foreclosures, and they had access to these. And the people who should be getting the chance at these, lower income or first time buyers especially, they were just ripped out from underneath them. So talk about interfering with the American dream. That was just a horrible thing. And that's what's happened. That actually is what's causing a lot of the rent prices to go up, because these corporations went in, bought these things, fixed them up, and they've instituted, it's a whole different playbook.
Well, John, you can certainly opine on this, but a lot of what we talk about on the show, especially down the Hale's doing all this research, is the difference in ability of people to access capital, the big corporations you're talking about. And I think, by the way, that's a pretty good idea of President Trump. I don't know exactly what the motivation was, but whatever it was, I think it's a pretty good idea. How much do you think that is? Those guys can buy a house and get the money to remodel it real easy, and some of the people who used to sell houses to your flippers have trouble. And why do they have trouble?
Because they have money already. That's an easy one.
Well, but I'm saying the access to capital is what Hal's talking about. Is so on. It's way more uneven than it ought to be. I mean, if somebody's in that business,
I will tell you. I think that yes, and I do agree with that. But there's also a reason for that. Is because if you remember back, there's just so many defaults when you gave first time buyers home loan programs, and so many people defaulted on them. This was huge.
Yeah, you're buzzing in and out. Right? If you're wandering back and forth from the mic.
It's my internet again. AT&T had. My signal varies. It may drop me because ever since the storm, they said they fixed it. It's not fixed right. So I'm going from 0 bars to 5. So sorry, everyone.
That's lovely. So, that's lovely.
I know. It's just lovely. And it happens for hours at a time. And I've called several times. Anyway, I digress. So that is the problem is also people shot themselves on the foot because they bought these homes and it was easy with 0 down. Back in our big recession in the 80s. And they kind of wrecked it for themselves because now when the industry came back, we've got the stringent requirements. And now, I don't know how much this helps, but when you participate in one of the state or federal home loan, mostly the state first-time buyer, you have to go to a class about how to own a home.
Really?
Yes, that's been for a while because they're trying to put a stop. Yeah. It's like a 2-hour class.
Well, you know, Art, I was listening to Jen and I were talking about it maybe 2 months ago, Jen. They were talking about the houses that were. When were we talking about houses in some areas that were going down pretty rapidly? It was Florida after the hurricanes, but some of it had spread. The three of us were on. We talked about the states that had spread to, that for some reason housing prices were dropping pretty heavily in Georgia. This had to be. Last December, November.
Yeah,
somewhere.
This was in Texas too.
Texas too. Yeah, and the weird part though is all the examples that they had on TV of houses that somebody had paid $400 for and are on the market for now $310. All of them were owned by BlackRock. Do you think those guys, in some areas, they got their ass kicked basically or not? I mean, here I don't think so, but it's not. John, didn't we go? What article did I pass?
Oh, right? Yeah, that was heavy concentration in those, the Southern Belt.
Yeah,
and some growing economies, institutional buyers for these houses. And you're right, Audrey. I mean, if you've got if you scoop up, 100 homes in one subdivision, they're all close to each other. You can do all of the rehab work and upgrading and everything else on volume savings because you got the workers there. They can go from place to place, from site to site. The average person trying to do that for the first time in their lives. Can't do that. It's going to take money they don't have, and the logistics now are just harder to get people to actually show up for the job and everything else. So somebody with some muscle like a BlackRock could get all this stuff done on the cheap, and in effect make it impossible for the average consumer to do the same thing.
Well, funny you guys.
It's so true. It's really hard, and the rents. I'll tell you, and with all the crying in Illinois about how much they're supposed to help people. They let this happen, and the rents, especially in poor areas, became astronomical. What's even more interesting is that the requirements and the forms that the people had to send in were, I think, daunting. And this happened in the rental market, also terribly in the rental market, where maybe the average rent was, let's say, maybe $1,000, and they came along, fixed the house up. Is it nice and pretty? Yes. But all of a sudden, if you go from your rent from $1,000 to $1,800 or $2,000, and with requirements that basically probably, shut maybe 80% of the residents out, what are you going to do? What's going to happen?
Well, Lord, you were rattling off yesterday some tax numbers, and I found those astounding. And I don't know if you off the top of your head, you were talking about, Lord was looking, she's always looking for something. She's got clients, obviously. And you were talking about some condos that their taxes are like $8,000. Was the stuff you were telling?
We're just starting to look, and she had specified some areas she wanted to look at, and it went from areas I'm in, Tinley, Tinley, Orland, Frankfurt, Lockport, Homer, like that area. It's just kind of my general area. And gave me a price range to work with, and I'm a few in her price range, but as I was printing them, going through them, I'm like, well, there's a dramatic difference in the taxes between, you know, Tinley, Lockport, Orlin, and the ones in Frankfurt, comparable size or smaller, that the taxes were maybe 6 to 8, and the two that she did want to see in Frankfurt were in the $9,000, almost $10,000 range.
And these aren't even houses; these are condos.
The maintenance fee is another $100 a month higher, so now you're going from $250 to $350. And when you're on a budget trying to get a mortgage, that those two things will knock you out of qualifying if you're pretty tight on what you could get.
And these weren't even houses; they were what, townhomes or condos?
Beautiful townhomes. I mean, we're talking beautiful housing, but that's, you know, it's a lot. But Frankfurt is known for their school district. You know, that's a big thing out there, is their schools. But we had to take them off the list because she says, I can't afford that extra, because that would have added another almost $300 a month to her payment.
Well, if you have four kids and you're paying $10,000, you're saving like a real lot of dough if the school systems are really good.
That's true, but if you're a single person and you don't care, then you have to reconsider where you're going to live.
Yeah, well.
Something that really shocks me, I mean, that 21% figure of, you know, of 21% of home sales to first-time buyers, in 2008, it was up to 40%.
That's because we were giving them away, and then it bit us in the butt.
Right, and there was lax underwriting, predatory lending. I mean, they were taking advantage of people who maybe should have waited a while, you know, before they launched in and put no money down or whatever. But it tells me there's something else about 2008 as a benchmark here that has really forever altered the entry point for, you know, owning a house.
Well, 2008 was a very unusual situation, Janet. I mean, let's hope it remains unusual, in that there were people that were in houses and they paid $235,000, the price got down to $165,000. They couldn't refinance, and God help you if you had a move. So the thing gets puked out at $165,000, and if you were available, why wouldn't you pile in? Plus, everybody's somehow convinced, I mean, we have Nancy on, I don't know, but that we're back to this 20% down stuff. No, we're not. Nancy?
No, that's not true.
Yeah.
No. If you could buy a conventional home with 3% down.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
But the problem, and John is so right, when all this happened, all bets were off, and the scamming in the mortgage market was terrible. It was terrible. And it got to the point where you could get money back on a loan. You were getting a mortgage for 110% of the value because you're for the cash. And when this all blew up because people didn't, you know, you weren't really screened. I mean, I could have gotten my dog a mortgage at that time. So the fact that it went from zero, and we had a clamp. I mean, obviously we had to review the mortgage industry, and it had to be clamped down, because then we couldn't afford another 2008 when the market and real estate both went down the tubes. You can't. That was the big thing. Is there was people. Nobody was safe, because whether you were an investor or a real estate person or a homeowner, you got affected by that.
Well, which of your dogs had the highest credit rating?
Pardon me?
Which of your dogs would you say had the highest credit rating?
Of course, my smart poodle.
Yeah.
Must be Abby.
Not my little Maggie. You didn't think she had much of what?
Well, little Maggie probably just can't pay cash. She was smart.
Audrey, you know, we're talking about first-time home buyers, and this is probably harder to quantify, but I'm wondering how many, say, second-time buyers who got wiped out the first time around in 2008 and, you know, sold on a short sale or bankruptcy or something else, and were spooked or just, you know, financially prevented from rejoining the housing market. Do you see many people at your end of it who are survivors of the, you know, mess in 2007, 2008, who put off buying a house because they got burned so badly the first time, or just walked away from ever trying to do it again? Are there people who have ventured out and are back on their feet and now on their second or third house? Or
that is such a great point. I would bet part of the problem in this country, I would bet you between 35% and 40% of the average person in the United States has never recovered from 2008. I would say that my they never. Too. Most people, their wealth was in their house. Most people, it's true. And unfortunately, people, we don't teach investing in this country, which is crazy. We don't teach how to save. And the people that had the most to lose and put everything in their house and lost it, and I don't think most, from what I've seen, that group has not recovered. And that's the shadow that's chasing part of the problem in the country.
Okay. Walk this through. You guys, I think, are both accurate. Walk through the numbers from the bottom. Somebody buys a house for $235,000. I went through these numbers in 2008 ad nauseum when I was on the score, which end. Somebody buys a house for $235,000, which was the median number. All right. So they put down $45,000, say. So now their mortgage is $190,000. The house is trading $180,000. These are people who actually put the money down. Everybody does talks about the people who didn't put money down, but I'm going to say that 80% of the people that got hurt did put the money down, and only people talk about the other 20%. So they put that down, and that 45 was either money the two of them had saved, like, forever, or it was their inheritance, or Papa gave it to them, or something along those lines. And I'm not saying anything wrong with any of that stuff, but it was equity. And now all of a sudden, that 45 grand equity is toast. It's just gone. Maybe the bank lost a little bit. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they broke even. And all of a sudden, these people had to transfer to God knows where, El Paso, where Mike Murphy's gone. I'm going to say that no way in hell, unless the parents had even more money, could give them round two. I don't see how those guys go someplace, start renting, and save up now the 80 grand you need, because the prices are... I don't see, unless you got some one hell of a job or some of the other... The wife's parents croaked and gave you the dough. I don't see how you ever make that up. Not ever, but I mean, how hard it is to make that up. It's incredibly hard.
Well, you can't. By the time, it was like, say, 2008 to almost, it was almost 10 years, so about 2018, until things started actually moving again. I think it really took, it was a long time. 2008 was about 4 years to kind of, 4 or 5 years to kind of have. It kept getting worse and worse and worse, and then it was stagnant, then we're coming back a little. But the people that, with everything, like, the game plan was you bought this house, you made money on it when you retired, you maybe sold it, downsized, and you bought your little retirement condo here, your place in Florida or whatever, and you lived on your pension and stuff. Well, if you lost your house and you lost your job, and you had to use up your savings trying to survive because there was no place to make money or do anything, that person, those families have never come back. And they won't. They won't. Because they didn't even have anything in reserve to participate in the upside of the stock market or the housing market. So they got left behind. And that's a big problem in this country that sits in the shadows.
Well, both of these, I think there's a... At the time, I was talking about how 2008, to me, well, there's probably been a bunch of recessions around, but most of the ones that I was involved in since I've been around, I would say are income statement recessions. The 1929 and 2008 were balance sheet recessions. In a normal recession for somebody, say you get laid off for 2 months, maybe you can go, you know, paint houses or do something, and this is showing my age, the wife can do something for a while, you have some savings, you work your way through it, you get a new job, you get hired back. That's, I won't say a normal recession, but that's most people's opinion of what a business cycle recession would be. 1929 was different. You didn't just get laid off, you went to the bank and you got a broken nose and they slammed the door in your face and they said your savings are toast. That's a totally different game. Same way as 2008. Well, I got all my money in this house. Guess what? It's gone. It's, to me, those two were singularly different. And I don't know. Do you guys agree with that or not? I mean, a regular business cycle recession just happens. And okay, you lose your job for 6 months. You find another one. And it's not always easy. And it's a tough time. But there's some slack there. You still have your savings. If you have some, you still got, you know, whatever. Go ahead, John. Talk.
They are anomalies. And what's different about the 29... crash and, you know, the collapse of housing, the people who had kids who were, say, in grade school or whatever in 29, who, you know, made it through the Depression, however, and then, you know, emerged in, you know, to the post-war world when things were booming, you know, they could get back on their feet. They married, they had a ton of kids, they bought a nice house, the suburbs exploded, and everything was kind of finally working out for them. I fear, like, you know, the people who lost out in 2007, 2008, when their entire investment got wiped out, if they were just starting out with a family then, those kids are now, you know, 18, 20 years old, their prospects going forward are so much worse than their parents were. Or anybody in 29 could weather the storm enough to emerge at the other end of the tunnel and have a chance at buying a house and having a somewhat happy life. I just see those. That's no wonder these, you know, 21% figure is there, because there is no way those families produce kids who can amass enough money to have a down payment, given that their parents lost everything 20, you know, some years ago. So I just find that this is like a self-perpetuating thing where those people are forever foreclosed from ever owning a house.
Well, that's the truth. I mean, it's and you see it in the kid. I don't see how anybody, you know, right now working, you know, for FINRA or the OCC or somebody making $65,000 a year renting an apartment in Chicago. I don't know where do they save up $80,000, Dodd?
Well, you know what I think too, and I completely agree with you guys, but I think we also raised a generation or two that, I don't know about even what my first apartment was, a rat trap, and it was an eye-opening experience about how much it costs to live in the world, even if you had an okay job when you're starting out. So I think the problem is when the last couple generations went out in the world, they thought right away they should have a really nice apartment, and you could buy a couple of Starbucks a day, and, you know, I go out to the bars and spend, you know, $50, $100, you know, a few nights a week and still save money. We also have not ever taught kids how to save money. And maybe you have to, it's the whole, not so much entitled, but the shock of what things cost in the real world. And if you want to have a nice life, not even a great life, how much sacrifice it takes. And sacrifice is something that the whole thing now where everybody wants things for free, you know, that's why I think the socialist movement's coming up. Nothing's free. It's going to cost you one way or another, but to have a nice life is an incredible amount of hard work. That's what I think.
Well, it depends. Unless you made money the old-fashioned way, you inherited it.
And, you know, it almost doesn't matter. I mean, yes, that's nice, but I've seen kids that have squandered that inheritance. And once they realized the gravy train had stopped, and then you really do have nothing. But the fact is, all of us mostly have had to make our own way. If you have to make your own way, you weren't out spending a ton of money all the time, and you didn't buy a brand new car every couple of years. I mean, so sacrifice and saving also hasn't been taught, on top of the fact that we've had a few really horrible times to go through.
Several generations of, shall we say, loser politicians lie to us over time, in the sense that if you compare whatsoever, just even if you go back to, well, if you go back to 2000 for sure, if you go back to 1980, you get a tremendous, you look at, you know, the number, I'll be brief here because we're running over time, but you look at what happened when John and I were in college. Okay, what at that point, let's say somewhat after, when I was working, and so was John, the later 70s, I'm working, and somebody on the line at Pullman, you know, was, you know, a pretty skilled guy, could make $18,000-$20,000 a year. All right, well, Notre Dame education is $4,000, a new car is $4,000, a house is $45,000 to $50,000. We're not talking about a mansion, but a house. And then you fast forward 20 years or 25 years, and the same guy's making maybe 75 or 80. The car is now 25. The house is 300. And, oh, by the Notre Dame education is 80. I mean, if you look at it that way, or when John, when you and I and Aud, when we were all first working, when did lunch cost you an hour's pay? Duh. I mean, come on. I mean, I never made any. I mean, I worked on the truck. I was very fortunate. I worked on the truck docks when I was in grad school, and I worked at the public schools, well, during the summer there, too, and then I'd work weekends on the truck dock. So I always had money. You know, I was not enough to buy anything, but for God's sake, what was a pitcher of beer at Samaris, John? $1.35 and a meatball sandwich is 59 cents, and I was making $3.50 an hour. So it, you know, I 1 hour was worth three pitchers. Now it's not, is it?
Even in your neighborhood bar, yeah, a bottle of beer is 50 or 75 cents.
Yeah, I mean, it was never. But this is insane. I don't know if you listened earlier, but Tiff told me that she and Nick went to the Cub game, not the Cub game. They went to a concert there. Two mixed drinks with tax was $45. They wanted a tip.
Well, my earning power never interfered with my beer drinking.
No, but now it surely does. The margin.
And you're eating. You're
eating. Oh God, yeah. But I mean, anywhere you go, any bar, even downtown. I mean, we're not talking about the crummy ones. After I go, a beer's $6. You go to Myers, and you know, I don't know if they're the cheapest on the shelf. They're 80 cents. We're not even in a. It has nothing to do with what they pay for anything now. The taxes, the lease, everything. They're probably not even making any money at $6. All this stuff, like Audrey's talking about, the tax, all this overhead, has gotten to the point where. I have to try and get Restaurant Al back on the air, because what he told me, that when he opened up this Italian place, no, they didn't have steaks and stuff on there. This is before COVID. He goes, everything on the menu was, you know, it's in Lincoln Park. Everything on the menu is $20 to $25, and it's mostly pasta dishes. And he goes, the his highest priced dish was linguine with clam sauce, because he put three or four regular clams in there. So that dish cost him $4.50. They charge $22.50 or $24 for it. Because it doesn't matter. I only have this many tables, and I can only turn it maybe twice. If the average person doesn't pay $35, if they don't get dessert, if they don't have a glass of wine, I break even on them because of the overhead and all the other stuff and the taxes. Because it almost doesn't matter what you eat.
Right.
Give me $50, I'll drink you and feed you all night. I don't care. But I need $35 a person to make a profit if I have this many, basically, butts in the seat on a given night. It's a totally.
And if I don't get that, you know, a couple weekends in a row, I close.
Yeah. And you know, it's a totally different dynamic than when we grew up and said, oh, gee, the hamburger's $10. How much does it cost you to make it? They don't care. If they fed you for free, it wouldn't matter. Almost, right. You know, it's a world we've entered, Aud, that's not even, you know, it's not our world, is it? But I guess it is now. Anyway,
very, very scary time.
Hey, throw out a shameless plug, will you?
Hey, okay, then I do have to make a correction too, because we did a new commercial for me. If you want to contact me, my number is 708-846-6494. That's 846-6494. My new email address is audrey@audreyjohnsonrealestate.com.
That's because one of these days you can give everybody the story on realtor.com. What? How scary that is.
That just gets me mad thinking about it.
I know. Well, pick a morning you're mad about something else, and then you can just stay mad for a while. But but realtor.com, how long did you have that email address?
Oh, my God.
Real quick answer.
25, 30 years.
And all of a sudden they said, no, we're not going to let the realtors have realtor.com anymore. John, do you believe that?
Man, that's so expensive.
They need it for their internal corporate people. I never heard, as I told the people who ran the place, I never heard such a bunch of BS in my entire life.
You think you'd at least
see how much good that does them.
Why not just say, if you want an email address here, it's going to cost you $50 or something. You know, I mean, something.
That would be a lot easier.
Yeah.
Pay for it in our dues.
Oh, yeah, I know.
We'll have to pay a lot of dues.
All right, guys, we got a dash. Good stuff. John, if you're around tonight, the Tripoli's having a golf outing party tonight, so who knows? You can't, you know, if you ever leave the place. Just saying. SP Futures.
That was the smoke.
SP Futures, now you got the breathing. You got the air quality. That can be your excuse. SP Futures up 32, NASDAQ Futures up 277. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks. Nice job, Jimmy.
That's all, folks.